The meeting of the Oregon Law Commission, and welcome everybody. If you read your minutes carefully, you'll know that this is the 9 o'clock meeting on December 14th. But I do want to welcome everybody and our guests assembled here. If you're looking for budget talks, that's down the hall in hearing room F. If you're here for law commission things, you've got the right place. It's kind of like what they say when you get on an airplane, you know, this is the plane bound for. Representative Williams is with us by telephone, and Max, so you know, we've got Commissioners Vail, Glindy, Myers, Carson, Blackhurst, Hansberger, and those are the commissioners here, and then our usual productive staff and a lot of usual guests as well today. We will get started with the Executive Director's report, and for that I will turn it over to you. I'm sorry, approval of minutes. We have that first. Commissioner Carson moves approval of the minutes of our meeting of September 21 at Seaside. Is there any discussion or any corrections to be made on the minutes before we...
Mr. Chair, one question.
Yes.
I've read these sort just kind of selectively. I haven't read through all, but one on page 18 of the minutes, at the very bottom, there's the summary of some comments by Hans, and I don't understand the way they're worded. If you'll read that first sentence, mentions he asked at the planning committee meeting a couple of days ago when this was presented whether anyone had done an elementary legal analysis. Now, here's where the confusion are, I'm going to clear, as to whether a company authorizes a state regulation on state law binding on federal courts. And apparently, you people, volatile appeal on one of the court decisions to determine. I'm not sure what the correct version of that is, but I don't believe this is...
What did you say?
I think that's verbatim.
I was, of course, giving Judge Lindy the benefit of the doubt. Perhaps unjustifiable.
Professor, do you have a particular recollection?
Do I?
Yeah.
I certainly have no verbatim recollection, but the point, of course, of it being made you can't work it by editing. I can see that. But of course, the point was simply to see whether anybody had litigated the question whether the regulation had legal effect in a state regulation and legal effect in a federal lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's about. If you want me to, I will submit. No, seriously. I'll just submit a written. Qualification and amend the minutes accordingly.
Sure, we can go to the we can go to the tape too on that. I remember the discussion, but I don't.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that makes no sense at all. I don't know where that came from.
All right. Are there any other comments on the minutes?
Do you understand it?
Then, Chief Justice, if I may, with the motion to approve the minutes, we'll make that subject to clarification by Professor Lindy of the statement that appears at item 252 on the bottom of page 18. Is there any discussion, any objection, and the minutes are approved as subject to that clarification. Now we go to the Executive Director's report, and that is you, Dave.
Thank you very much. Two items, Roman numeral 2-1 has to do with the contract renewal for the continued provision of Executive Director and related services. I want to highlight one significant change from last year's contract, our first year contract, and that is the availability of dollars through the commission to all three law schools for the purpose of retaining research assistants at all three schools. I've sent emails to Dom and to Bernie and to Sandra, and our hope is that as projects continue to mature at those other schools, we'll be able to bring law students from each of those schools online to help us with the project. So that's good news. And again, I think it was at Wayne's request we wanted to provide the contract for information purposes so you can see how that is working. Happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Okay. Next item.
Thank you. The next item, Roman 2, number 2, is Exhibit D in your materials, and it has to do with what we're calling a memorandum of understanding. If no action is taken on this memorandum of understanding, appearing as Exhibit D, your executive director's staff will incorporate the statement that appears on page 2 of Exhibit B, lines 74 through 82, into the work group letters of appointment that we will use henceforth, and we will send this same text to current work group members to remind them of their obligations as we envision them as a commission. This, you will recall, is the general subject that we've discussed a number of times as a commission about the nature and scope of the representative capacity of various work group members when they come and serve as they do, largely as volunteers on our commission work group. My hope is that having read this two-page memo of understanding, looked at the text, particularly lines 74 to 82, that no action would be required and we would implement essentially as you see it here. Mm-hmm. One final point procedurally, this two-page memo was presented to the program committee as a matter of information and discussion. Some nice changes were suggested there. It comes to you as a full commission without a recommendation as such from the program committee, but we did run it through there initially to get some preliminary feedback, and it comes for you today for discussion and consideration. It's my hope that this will be received by the commission and no action beyond that taken, and we'll conduct ourselves as described in the memo.
All right. We are into discussion then of this Exhibit B. I'll just mention that the review, or not review, but the presentation of this to the program committee was primarily just to get a preliminary read on this from commission members generally. This didn't particularly come under the purview of the program committee to advance or to act on, but I think Dave wanted to get a sense of what commissioners were thinking about a draft, and so it was vetted then at the program committee, but as he said, does not come to us with any action having been taken by the program committee. So it is before us, pristine, and it's in the form that we see, and I'll be glad to receive any comments or have discussion about it. Does anybody need any further background to this? We talked about.
This is Max. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I do. You know, I did read over the language in the memoranda, and I've got, I guess, a little bit of a concern that I wanted to raise, at least, or listen to the commission, the other commissioners sort of discuss. I wasn't part of the discussion that occurred at the program committee level, so to the extent that that discussion would have clarified my thoughts on this and taken away my concerns, I apologize if I'm going to make you rehearse any of that.
That's okay. Most of the commission members were not present at that discussion, so that's fine. But that's why I say this is pristine.
One of my concerns is, and I only have my sort of recent experience on the commission with, for example, the judgment and garnishment work groups as examples, but I sense that we're moving towards, with this adoption or with this memorandum of understanding and the language, a more formalistic approach to the operations of the work groups. And while I don't necessarily resist that formalization, I can tell you that a number of the participants in both those work groups do represent interested parties. They're either lobbyists or they're retained counsel, or they're frankly counsel who represents a particular kind of client on a regular basis. And I thought, frankly, at least in my experiences, the strength of our work groups came from having those diversities of interest as participants. Whether they be folks, for example, from the Attorney General's office who represent the support enforcement side of that issue and provided us invaluable information to make sure we didn't screw those things up, vis-a-vis the Bankers Association or the collectors or the public legal aid folks who were representing essentially the debtor side of those issues. It was that very representation of those interest groups that I think gave the proposals and the eventual work product we came to their strength. And I'm a little hesitant to just think that we ought to make all those people suspend their representative capacity in those discussions as we ask them to participate in these kind of work groups.
Well, I think you've identified the tension that probably is at the heart of this. And attention just in the sense that we do want diversity. We want broad representation, but with the same time, same token, I think the idea is that the recommendations that come from the work group to the commission should by the time of final action, represent considered decisions based on good public policy as individual members of the work group perceive them, and not necessarily be driven by their particular groups that they represent. And then, like I say, that is tension. I don't know how to state it otherwise. Let's see, Steve. I think you fussed with the language of this.
I mean, Max, we shared your concern about that in terms of its how the work groups have functioned to date. And I think it was actually Greg that suggested some different language, which I think is incorporated in here. Mm-hmm. If I'm correct, Greg.
Yeah, if I could address that, Max, the original.
I can't. If Greg is trying to speak, I can't hear him.
Okay, I am trying to speak, and you can't hear me.
Can you hear him now?
No, I really can't. I can hear people who are centered around those mics, but if you're far from it, I think it's sort of tough.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Great. Max, this is Greg. The original draft of the language had a somewhat stronger admonition, and it was worded something along the order of members are not, see if I can find the original draft.
I think you're looking at the operative language is on lines 80 through 82 right now.
It's 80 through 82, and originally it had language of the effect that they are not to represent their clients. And what we modified that to was to read, they are not to subject their individual and professional judgment to representation of client or employer interests. And the intent of that language, although it may be a little vague, the intent was to recognize that it may well be appropriate to appoint members based on a representational interest, but when it comes to a final vote, the vote is not a vote, it's not a representational vote, but an individual vote. And that, again, is still a tension, but it represented some movement from where we started.
Okay. Well, I can appreciate the tension, and I recognize its role. I mean, I have always believed that certainly the services commissioners, albeit somewhat representational in the nature that the statute appoints us, are bringing our sort of best professional and legal judgment to bear as we make votes as commissioners. My work groups that I've participated in so far, I guess, have been less formal in that we have never brought an issue to a vote in front of the work group on a particular recommendation. We've always managed to get to a consensus version of whatever we were going to bring forward to the commission, and so it's been a looser, less formalistic process, and that's worked for the issues that I've been involved in, and I hate to see that formalization. I guess I'm a little concerned, for example, if that's a working model, that this will somehow now inject a certain formality into that model that will, you know, create more tension and be a bar to that consensus building as opposed to doing just the opposite. So those are my concerns. I'm not sure there's any way to resolve them, and I'm not sure that the language as it's currently written in the long run would probably change anything, but I wanted to be on the record at least expressing some concern about excluding interest groups that I think to a great degree for this to practically work need to be included as we move towards these problem-solving approaches on some of the more thorny issues we take on.
Further discussion. Those are good comments.
Down here,
Professor Lindy.
Yes. Max, just to clarify this in the record, as you say, I don't think anybody is supposed to be excluded. There's no suggestion that people who represent clients shouldn't come and participate. This has nothing to do with that. Participation is fine. If you say you're there to represent a particular interest, you say it, and that's just great. The only thing is that, as Greg, I think you said, there is a problem if you don't reach consensus. If that has happened, it can happen again, and then you have to have some idea about how does the work group report to the full commission.
Okay, And again, that's fine, and I understand the position. I think that, you know, it won't be unlikely in our future that we will have, majority and minority positions coming out of certain work groups. And again, I've never been troubled by the fact that work group members might represent a particular segment or a particular interest group, because in the end, it's the commission that really has to take the formalistic act of deciding to refer something on to the legislature. And I've always thought that that was sort of the place where that would get filtered through a much more objective lens. But as I said, I'm not here to try to rain on the adoption of this language per se. I simply wanted to make sure that we had sort of this tension out on the table and could have a more open discussion about it. And I'm going to be sort of in my own service on the commission interested in seeing how we develop, because I am worried that if we move too closely or too far to a formalistic approach to these work groups, that we are going to lose some of the very sort of positive nature of the way the commission's been able to operate to date, and I just want to sort of put that out on the table. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will now be quiet.
Okay, no, those are good comments, and I'm glad to have them in the record, because they are concerns I have about this. Although I recognize the benefit of trying to address the tension with a policy or a statement like this. I'll say also for the record that it's not my intention by this to inject any particular new degree of formality to the work group process. I think the work groups have been functioning very well on a consensus basis for the most part. And I think they should continue to move to work along those lines. We do need it, and we will be working to formalize more the actual membership of work groups, so we know exactly who the work group participants are and who they are not, and that'll be helpful, I think, for regular attendance and noticing and things like that. But I don't suggest by this that this is any move, and I think I should say this so the commissioners who are chairs of work groups will know that this is not a move to create some more formalized decision-making process in the work groups. I don't see that as being necessary or even particularly desirable. And if anybody thinks otherwise, let's talk about that too. Okay, and assuming that we move forward and adopt this today, I will be interested to see over the course of the next few months as we disseminate this to work group members and new work group members whether this creates a problem for us in persuading people to participate as work group members. And if it does, then I think we need to be ready to revisit this because I don't want this to cause a chilling effect on the what so far has been a pretty robust participation by a lot of different interest groups and representatives of interest groups on our work groups. Anybody else? Okay. This is not before us for any action. This is just to recognize that the executive director will maintain this and distribute it to work group members. Although, again, I think I do want to have take the temperature of this from time to time and see how it's being received and whether we're getting any comments from work group members, and if we are, I want to be very sensitive to that, because we've got a good relationship with all of those volunteers coming in so far, and I don't want to jeopardize that.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? All right, then let's go on with number three, the program committee. I guess I'll turn this over to the Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just to put the first matter before us formally, I would move that the commission adopt the recommendation of the program committee to endorse the juvenile court guardianship proposal, which is Exhibit U in today's materials, and authorize the juvenile code revision work group to include the proposal within its projects.
All right. That is the motion to accept the recommendation of the program committee to endorse the juvenile court guardianship proposal and authorize the Juvenile Court Revision Work Group to include the proposal within its projects. Is there a discussion? You want to follow up on that?
Briefly, the problem is set forth at the outset of Exhibit U. and I think set forth pretty succinctly. We've got a gap, if you will, in the alternatives available to dealing with situations in which something akin to a permanent arrangement for a child is to be made, and this study would inquire into the desirability of creating a guardianship arrangement in accord with the alternatives envisioned by the Adoption and Safe Families Act passed by Congress in 1997.
Timothy Travis is here. If there are any questions?
Yeah. Timothy Travis, who brought this to the program committee, is here if anyone has any questions. Senator Brown, did you want to comment at all on this?
After this, no more. Code rewrite.
Does that mean this is very much
needed in terms of juvenile court processes, which I have been out of for a few years now, but we need to do this, frankly. The guardianship creations that we're having right now simply don't have the adequate oversight and process that they need to have in order to make sure children are protected in the state. So,
I believe, Mr. Chair, this will be 6 work groups for the subwork groups for the Senator Brown.
Well, and that is sort of why I called on the Senator, just to make sure that you're okay with this.
This is fine. We need to do this.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Travis? He is here, and I can tell you he is knowledgeable about the proposal. Okay, I'll bet if it was 9 o'clock, we might have some questions. But all right, then the motion is to accept the recommendation of the program committee to endorse the Juvenile Code Guardianship Proposal and authorize the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group to include the proposal within its projects. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Mr. Myers.
Chair, I would move that the Commission accept the recommendation of the Program Committee to endorse the Conflict of Laws Work Group's proposal regarding torts, and that's found at Exhibit D, and authorize the Conflict of Laws Work Group to continue.
Okay. We've already established this Conflicts of Law Work Group. This represents the outline of their proposal and how they intend to proceed. Conversation, I guess, about this.
I'm happy to report that a member of the work group and former chair, Don Vetri, is here, and Simeon Simeonides sends his regrets. He is still recovering from surgery. He'll be fine, but is glad that Dom is here to maybe share a word or two on this one.
Please, Dom.
Building on our success with the contract conflicts proposal, we'd like to move forward with the torts area. This time around, Professor Naxiger will serve as the reporter, and our own Dean Simeonides will serve as the chair of the committee. You should know that probably Dean Simeonides is the foremost scholar and expert in the United States on torts conflicts matters, so it'll be a real opportunity for the two experts to work together in helping us bring some order out of this area. The torts area is obviously the one that's more difficult to manage than the contracts area. The contracts sort of had the anchor of party autonomy. Whatever the parties agree on in the contract can be the basis for the choice of law decision. In the torts area, it's a lot more complicated because the parties usually don't have any relationship or a voluntary relationship together. But we're looking forward to being able to pull this together and perhaps come forward with proposals for the next session.
Okay. Questions or discussion, either for Dave Kinnegy or Commissioner Vetri? All right, seeing none, the motion is to accept the recommendation of the Program Committee to endorse the Conflict of Laws Work Group proposal regarding torts. That's found in Exhibit D, which naturally follows Exhibit U, and authorize the Conflict of Laws Work Group to continue. It seems to me this recalls a comment about minding your P's and Q's that goes back to our last meeting. But Oh, that's right. That was the low-hanging fruit. That was.
Yeah, that was Max's.
It
was so low-hanging.
Yeah, it bears repeating. Commissioner Vetri noted, I have appointed Commissioner Simeonides to serve as chair of the work group, and Professor Jim Nofziger at Willamette to serve as reporter, and both of them have agreed. So, if there is no further discussion, is there any objection? And hearing none, that is ordered as well. And then we are back to item number 3.3.
Mr. Chair, I would move the commission accept the recommendation of the program committee to endorse the proposal from the State Family Law Advisory Committee, and that we're now on the right alphabetical track, exhibit E, following D, and approve the formation of a judicial and administrative child support order work group.
Okay. The motion is to accept the recommendations of the program committee to endorse the proposal from the State Family Law Advisory Committee at Exhibit E and approve the formation of a judicial and administrative child support order work group. Commissioner Hansberger has agreed to serve as chair of this work group, and for that I thank you. Who wishes to expand on this? I know we have some of the proponents with us today. Sandra, do you want to talk about this? Or?
Well, I would only say I did attend the program committee meeting where this proposal was brought forward, and it's obviously something that is in need of great attention to resolve the difficulties between the administrative child support process and the judicial process. So it's something that seems long overdue. The proposal seems to be very well-founded, and I would hope that this is something the commission would adopt as well. And I'm sure that any of these people here in the front row can address any specific issues that people have.
Are there any questions? Anybody want to hear a speech about this? I will just comment briefly, not on the substance of the proposal, but I appreciate the opportunity that is presented to the commission to become a participant in this. I think this is something that's been an ongoing discussion among the various stakeholders involved in the issue, and I think having the Law Commission as an entity has given them a place to go to marshal the resources to try and resolve some of the outstanding conflicts in this, and they're largely bringing their own resources to do that, but we're providing them with the umbrella staff support as well, and so I'm pleased to be utilized like this by groups that are coming to the commission, and we've got an issue, and we think if we work with you, we can maybe get this resolved. So I hope so. We've got a good track record so far.
I do have one other comment. I'd like to make sure that reference is made, particularly for those members of the program committee, to the addition to Exhibit E that is referred to as the December 7 supplement to the revised proposal. It illustrates here again the depth of understanding and commitment that's coming to the commission from the SFLAC as they, in response to Hardy Meyer's request, have provided further, if you will, background and support for the scope and the work that's contemplated. I'd also just ask if the commission is of a mind to do so, that with the people who have gathered here today, and further to the notion that your collective understanding of these issues be deepened, if you'd like to hear from the people who have arrived here today, it might provide a little bit of upfront background for the full commission, so that as proposals come forward through Commissioner Hamsberger's work and others, you'll be better equipped to deal with it prior to the next legislative session. Just a thought, but I'd like to sure honor the fact that some folks have driven a great deal of distance in lousy weather to come here, but if they're waving us off, that's another point I want to make. So, just wanted to mention.
Well, okay, Rennell did come all the way from West Salem. I would be pleased to turn the podium over to you if you have any, if you want to. I'll tell you, I had no notion what this was about until I sat through the hour-long discussion out of the program committee, and it's very interesting. Very interesting issue to me, but by the same token, I don't want to twist any arms here. Here comes Rennell.
Thank you. Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support. I have not been the division representative serving on the Statewide Family Law Advisory Committee. My counterpart, Bob David, has been doing that because he is out with eye surgery today. This is the perfect forum, in our opinion, for this issue. And the documents that you have before you that were prepared by the SFLAC explain it very well. The work of Melissa Seidlick and Maureen McKnight and Jean Fogarty, who are all in the audience but don't necessarily need to come to the microphone, I think explains it well. I would just reiterate that this truly has been a long-standing issue in Oregon within the child support program. Your documents and the exhibit indicate that formally, as far as the legislative concept, it really started in 1995, but the discussion has been going on much longer. I think we've really reached a milestone in that the significant players internally with an Oregon Child Support Program, together with legal aid, have reached a conceptual agreement, and that was a huge part of what was happening in the past. We weren't on the same page, and we are today conceptually, so we are looking for a forum to carry the issue and bring all of the other important players to the table. And the work that I've seen done by this commission led us to believe that if the SFLAC could bring it forward, which they have done in a very fine manner, to this group, this is the perfect forum.
Now, let me ask, if you can't get the whole thing solved in time for legislation for the 2003 session, are there discrete pieces of this? I mean, can you do it in increments?
Absolutely, Chair Shetterly. There are several pieces that are likely to come forward in the work group when all of the partners come to the table at once. But the first piece that we're really seeking, that I think is described in the scope of work, is to just give us some statutory answer to what should we do when the situation occurs in Oregon that we have both an administrative and a judicial order for the same family unit. Give us direction there so we can start dealing with all the cases that exist. And then there definitely are larger issues that could be taken on in other phases. But that first step would be immense.
Are you by chance looking for a solution where the duality of the orders would not be possible, where there would be either an administrative or a judicial but not both? Or is the existence of both orders simply something that we have to live with?
Professor, that is definitely an outcome that we would eventually like to reach. That will probably take a lot of discussion, how you avoid this happening in the first place. There are several factors involved in why it does occur. And I think that we can eventually remedy several of them, but ultimately in today's society, with the way that the child support caseload is, we will probably never totally eliminate this from occurring.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you, Ronell. Maureen, Jean, either of you want to speak on this? Okay. Pardon? Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. No, she's okay. Nobody else.
Everybody's waving you.
Well, I like these Friday 3 o'clock meetings.
Now you know.
Let's start the next one at 4:30. In that event, then we will move on with the action on the motion. It again is to accept the recommendation of the program committee to endorse the proposal from the State Family Law Advisory Committee found at Exhibit E, and that includes the original Exhibit E and the supplement, I should note, and approve the formation of a judicial and administrative child support order work group. Is there any further discussion on that motion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered, and again, the chair has already appointed Commissioner Hansberger, or have I appointed her? Or we've talked about it. Okay. I predict that I will. Okay, then we are up to item four. That's the eminent domain work group. Mr. Attorney General.
I would move, Mr. Chair, that the commission endorse the eminent domain work group's work plan found at, staying in the right alphabet channel here, Exhibit F.
All right. The
motion. And authorize the work group to proceed with the work plan.
Thank you. The motion is to endorse the eminent domain work group's work plan, that is at Exhibit F, and authorize the group to proceed with the work plan. Greg, do you want to address this?
Well, this must be a report on the status.
Right. We've already created the work group. This is your work plan.
Right. This work group has met twice. It's a very active work group. I think it's always a good sign when you have as many people show up the second time as showed up the first time. Judge Levy has agreed to join our work group, and we have a good balanced panel of condemnor and condemnee representation. We have identified many, many issues under Chapter 35, and we've also identified two current problems on pre-condemnation inspection and contaminated properties that hopefully can be addressed before the next legislative session. That's a fairly optimistic view, but we'll do our best. And we've created some sub-work groups that are set to meet next month and report back our first statutory proposals.
Okay. Any questions for Greg? All right. With that, then, we'll take up the motion to endorse the eminent domain work group's work plan and authorize the work group to proceed with the work plan. Again, Commissioner Mao is chair of this work group, and Professor David Cameron, Willamette University, is the reporter for the work group. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. So that takes us to the work group updates, starting first with the civil rights work group. And Wendy, I think you were going to take that.
So in Jeff Carter's absence, Mr. Chair, this group continues from last session. At the last commission meeting at Seaside, two work group proposals were approved. This group has not met yet. As you'll recall, there was some discussion about whether there really was a fix needed. And so we have hired a research assistant, and with that research assistant and myself, we're planning to send a memo off to Jeff Carter this next week.
Okay.
And they should be starting here.
Okay. I believe this was the discussion that we were looking at in the minutes, wasn't it? The discussion about the civil rights work group. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. For commissioners, so you'll note that the updates here, there are 11 of them. Well, I think in talking with Dave Kanegi, our intention will be to sort of maintain this portion of the agenda as a regular report on all of our work groups. Some of them will have more comprehensive reports than others, but this will be a way for us every meeting to be reminded of what we're working on. So whether there is progress or not, we will list all of these work groups each time so that we have before us what we are currently working on. So that takes us to the Conflicts of Laws work group and Professor Petrie.
Nothing more to add.
Nothing more than you had in your last. Yeah, okay.
Gearing up to get started, and some additional committee members will be adding.
Okay. Eminent domain, Greg, we just talked about that, so you're covered there as well. All right. Judgments and enforcements of judgments work group. Congressman, shall I turn this over to Dave Hendricks? Do you want him to report on this?
Yeah, that would be terrific if he would come forward and do that. It would be easier for all of you probably to hear it from Dave. And he attended the last meeting, which I unfortunately was unable to attend.
Yeah. Dave?
The judgment work group has met twice now. We've got a very broad, large group of people who have turned up for both meetings now. Representative Williams has noted is chairing the work group again after last session, and Representative Shetterly kindly sat in on the last meeting, and I think he can tell you we've had begun with some interesting discussions about vigorous discussions about what should have been a fairly arcane subject, but one that will probably determine the way any subsequent legislation is drafted, starting with how to define what a judgment is, which you would think would not be that difficult, but has resulted in substantial amount of comment. The primary problems that we have been dealing with have to do with the many different significant things that come with calling a judge's decision, a particular judge's decision, a judgment, and primarily from the point of view of what is appealable. A problem that has bedeviled the courts for a long time and has resulted in substantial appellate cases, as problems have come with people appealing things that they thought were judgments that were not, et cetera. And at this point, what we're primarily working at in the I am working with the chair of the Oregon State Bar appellate section, is to try to come up with something that will hopefully aid practitioners in looking at this definition of what a judgment is, to maybe get rid of some of the problems that have crept up in the past with, and also to try to tell the courts, make sure the courts know the significance that they're going to have to say on these documents, this is a judgment, to try to get that very, very clear to all the participants. And so we're working on that. We do have a draft that's already been circulated that's going to be rewritten very shortly to take into account some of the new judge definitions that we're coming up with. But it seems to be going along well if we can get past some of these initial big picture issues.
Mr. Chair, I wish them well if our history on the court after Carriage House and admonishing lawyers, there is no such thing as judgment order.
Yeah.
That was 20 years ago, and it's still used by most practicing lawyers and judges. So I wish you well, and could you make it a felony?
Measure 11.
Yeah, right.
Well, going back to Representative Williams' comments, this is a work group where I can say from experience having chaired it at the last, sat in at the last meeting, where we are very fortunate to have representatives of various groups as active participants in this. It's interesting, you mentioned the appellate section, and of course for them, the thing they want more than anything else in the world is for us to define judgment so that it is usable for appellate purposes, knowing when a judgment is appealable and when it's not. But then we have the title companies who are represented there by their counsel, and whose main interest is knowing when it's a lien and when it's not a lien. What are the lien rights that attach? And then the other is judgment creditors who need to know enforceability apart from the lien issues. And it's just very interesting. And those are folks who all have discrete viewpoints and experience with judgments that need to be heard and represented on the work group.
And then, of course, Ronell and Jean, oh, yeah, of course, are actively there from the Attorney General's office because we're looking at some of the language that have come into the statutes over the years addressing child support obligations, where we have a situation now where in a child support case we have language and judicial decisions as well that have said that as each child support payment becomes due, it's a new judgment, creating further conceptual difficulties as to what do we really mean by a judgment if you can have a case where in an individual case you can have 200 judgments as each one becomes due. Things that came into effect, in that case a court decision, to try to deal with the problem of not wanting to create liens immediately when a divorce decree came down for the full amount of the obligation over time, the lien effect and also enforceability. Things that I think if we work at it long enough here and if everybody can kind of get on the same page, we may be able to resolve a lot of that and get us away from some of those difficulties and go back into those statutes and perhaps not necessarily talk anymore about individual payments creating a judgment, but saying that those individual payments as they come due create lien effect or become enforceable or try to identify. And that's one of the things we're doing. We're trying to say, what does it mean when you say you have a judgment? What comes? What's the result of that? What comes from that? And hopefully we can work it through and get some resolution on some of those things.
Mr. Chairman, I've got two questions for you, David. One is, will there be other terminology to be used for things that are not meant to be judgments? Will that be covered, or is that just going to be left the way it is?
Commissioner Lindy, the answer to that would be that anything that isn't a judgment, that is a decision of the court, will be in order.
Okay.
That is the plan right now.
And the second thing is, I think I heard you say something about instructions to judges to file judgments, to make some kind of a clear designation as a way of helping appellate lawyers. Is that what you said? I wasn't sure what you said there.
Well, the point is that, and this is primarily coming from comments from Brad Flank representing the Judicial Department on the work group, he indicates that there, even though the statutes currently say that anything that is a judgment must say at the top of the document that reflects this judgment must say judgment. He indicates that they still have problems with that in the 12 courts, not necessarily getting that idea. And a lot of it relates to such things as confusion arising out of summary judgment, where one party goes in and moves for summary judgment just to get them out of the case. And then the question is, what does the court enter after the court agrees and grants the summary judgment?
Okay.
And things like, that's the issue.
The thing that I was thinking about is, I don't believe that if a judge does call something a judgment, that settles that issue for an appeal. I mean, you can always argue that was a mislabeling, that there was not properly, shouldn't have been a judgment. So you don't give it any conclusive effect.
No, of course not. The Court of Appeals or the appellate court is always going to have a shot at looking at what the judge has said is in fact a final decision and say, well, you may have decided it was, but in this case you were wrong. One of the clear examples of that is we have one of the ORCPs, and I can't remember the number, indicates that the court has authority at any time to make a decision that for one party or one issue that there's no further need for the party to remain to wait until the end of the case in order to appeal it and allow them to proceed immediately with an interlocutory appeal.
The 67B, yeah.
Yes, and I think that the courts in the past, fellow courts have not been shy about coming back in and saying, no, you shouldn't have granted in this case. I don't know. But I don't think that the fellow courts are bound by that determination, for instance.
Okay. Any further discussion on the judgments group? Seeing none, well, I'm kind of tempted to move this to the bottom just to make you folks stay. Oh, and there's a pregnant woman there, too. I can't do that. We'll go to judicial review.
We're going to resume work for this biennium on January the 9th. That's our present target date. Dave Hendricks will be working with us again, and I appreciate his availability to do that, given his immersion with the work in the last biennium. And I'm not quite finished yet with the composition of the work group itself. I need one more opportunity to confer with you, Mr. Chair, around a couple, three of the slots that pertain to local government and how those should be best handled in light of the representational, we might have a memorandum of understanding that we discussed earlier, how that should or shouldn't affect those invitations in the context of this specific issue. And I will be talking to you the first of the week about that. The starting point of the work, as I think I may have discussed in the commission before, will be the measure that was introduced in the last session, coupled with the identification, which Philip Schradl, I believe, has finished, of the principal issues or concerns, text-based, that were brought forward either in the legislative process or commission stage and remain in the text at this point. I think that will be a fruitful way to start the work again and to try to make maximum efficiency of the use of the times of the members, as opposed to viewing this as an exercise of going back and just starting all over again as if there were no substantial text already developed, in which a great deal of time is embedded, obviously. So I hope to be able to have a fairly substantive progress report for you at the next commission meeting.
Questions? So that would take up then not just comments received in testimony, but also I think Greg and Sandra, you had some comments that never really got fleshed out as the bill went forward. I think to give a chance to look at those two then afresh as well.
Morning, afternoon.
Okay. If there's nothing further on that, Juvenile Code Revision Work Group and its subgroups, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and fellow commissioners and sister commissioner. I'm like, how are we going to get out of this one? We met, the last meeting that we had as a large work group was October 19th. We were unable to meet when you all were at the bar. We generally meet the third Friday of the month. And we had planned to meet December 21st, but since I'm going to be gone, most of my members are also going to be gone, and we are going to cancel the meeting. So, but we will meet January the 18th or the 19th, the third Friday.
18th.
Great. And I anticipate that all of our work groups will have written reports at that point in time. The expansion statute is, work group is being chaired by Amy Holmes-Haynes. She's WDA out of Multnomah County. And Ingrid Swenson, who's with OCDLA, is the vice chair. That will be very interesting if they can move forward on anything on that issue. It's a process-oriented work group in order to deal with the different processes of expungement and dealing with juvenile court records. It's pretty interesting. I hope they can come up with something. Wendy, do you have an...
They've met once, and they are progressive.
Good.
Which means...
They're moving forward. They think
they're agreed to meet again.
Which means they'll meet again.
They'll meet again.
They've elected a vice chair.
The juvenile PSRB is being chaired by Mary Claire Buckley. I don't have a vice chair on my list, but this issue is actually a holdover from last interim, and the whole issue is to deal with youth who are involved in the criminal system who are either unable to aid and assist or have severe mental illnesses, and we basically have no place in our system for these young people. We know it's going to be a resources issue. Mary Claire Buckley, who's head of the Adult Psychiatric Security Review Board, is chairing it. I anticipate they'll be moving in a direction of having a juvenile PSRB, but there may be some different flavors to it based on the youthful nature of some of the clientele. We do need on this group a committed House member from the Oregon legislature. I haven't been able to find a Senate member, and I was hoping we could find a House member. So if anybody has any brilliant ideas, I'd really appreciate it.
Is this on the PSRB specifically?
Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm. On that work group specifically. And this work group keeps getting larger and larger, and I talked to Mary Claire Buckley. I know they have met, and I hope they will be meeting again before January 18th.
They've met twice as a small group. Bill Taylor and Judiciary Committee have agreed to help with this group, and they're planning to have the whole group meet in January.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Oh, Professor.
I just have a question. You just said that the work groups keep getting bigger and bigger as if they're cannabis pesticides. How do they get on? I mean, this is part of the discussion we were going to have later, sooner or later, about the process. Do the sub work groups chairs to let anybody come who wants to come, or do you have to sign off on it? How does this work?
As a practical matter, Professor Lenny, what we've been doing is I've been signing off on additions. Only when we've added people to the formal full work group have we gone through the chair itself. But when we when this group was originally formed, it's actually less than 10 people on it, and we didn't have a good representation of folks like, for example, the DA's office and some of the mental health community. So we are making sure that we have all perspectives represented in this particular work group, given the complexity of the issue. So the other work groups aren't quite so big or as difficult, I think.
Yeah, I think the thing about that policy we were discussing is that there's absolutely no reason why people cannot be asked to participate at will and represent anybody they wanted to represent. It would be very valuable. But the question then is, who's the work group? And so at the present time, you approve of it.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Moving on.
Let's see. Juvenile code word usage. Timothy Travis is chairing that, and Linda Gus is the vice chair. I know they have met one time, and they are, this is actually also a holdover from last work cycle. They're wrestling with issues like, in the juvenile code, I'm just thinking of a word, wardship means a whole lot of different things, and they're trying to get one meaning for every particular word. It's used in several different ways, and they want to have words that mean the same thing throughout but don't have multiple meanings. It's pretty tricky because they've run into trouble on substantive issues on this one. So, but they're working on that one. That's actually been a couple-year project, so they're still going. Juvenile court guardianship, which we just appointed today, or we just approved today, we had already approved in anticipation of this group approving the proposal that Lisa Kay from Juvenile Rights Project would chair that group and Timothy Travis would vice chair that group. One of the other reasons why we're trying to branch out a little bit on our work groups is that you'll start hearing the same names over and over again, like Timothy Travis, mm-hmm. This is his job, but Lisa Kay is an attorney at Juvenile Rights Project, so is Kathy Osborne. I assume that Kathy, for example, had part-time caseload and a part-time legislative lobbying load. Well, it turns out she has a full-time caseload and sort of lobbies during the session full-time. So basically she's two loads, so we're trying to expand the workload a little bit. So anyway, Lisa is chairing that, and Timothy Travis will vice chair that. And then the delinquency petition notification to non-custodial parent, that essentially, we've already resolved that issue. It's very straightforward. We just need to get it drafted from legislative council. So that entails making sure that both parents, whether they're custodial or not, are notified when a child is involved in a delinquency proceeding. Right now, only the custodial parent is notified. It seems appropriate that we notify both parents if available. So, there's no work group, so we're really only at five.
Okay. Whew. Okay.
And my legislative assistant is keeping tabs on the workers, but he was involved in finals at Willamette University Law School these last couple of weeks, so I've had a hard time talking to him.
I thought we were going to get him an exemption.
Mr. Chair?
No, very good, yes.
Just a suggestion, if it's feasible, maybe one or more of these work groups where they're rather complicated and involve a lot of research. Each law school has at least one expert on juvenile law. Maybe if we approach a specific individual, ask them to be a reporter for that particular sub-work group, that would assist the people and help you in making some progress. I think you'd probably find some of the people at the schools very willing to do that.
That's great. And one of the issues, obviously, is for our committees have been finding reporters. And when people have full-time caseloads and full-time legislative loads, it's just really hard to ask them to do an additional work. So that's a great idea. Thank you.
And I think that also furthers the objective of the executive director, the contract agreement that we looked at first. It also moves some money specifically into a category to be dispersed to the other law schools to involve them. So that's excellent. That's a good way to put that to work. All right. Did that cover it? Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Senator Brown? Continuing her brave march, or is it long march to the juvenile?
Oh, I did miss her. I'm sorry, I did miss her.
Did you do delinquency procedures? Okay, I thought we...
Basically, you might recall last time we passed House Bill 2611, which was a rewrite of the Juvenile Dependency Code. It created basically a code of procedure for juvenile dependency. Kathy Osborne is chairing the march to provide a delinquency code along the same lines. So we should have a very neat package by the time we're done with the 2003 legislative session.
Excellent. Okay. Next we have the Saving Statute Work Group, Professor Vickery.
I can tell you, this has nothing to do with banks or financial institutions. It probably has more to do with saving the rears of attorneys. it's a statute that deals with the issue of when a case is dismissed for reasons other than on the merits, can it be refiled? The common example is the maybe failure of service or process for technical reasons, and the statute of limitations has already expired, and can you refile that, or do you have to litigate the issue of whether the service was proper or not?
and Professor Holland, who's the reporter for this particular work group, has found that just a lot of litigation goes on in Oregon at the appellate level over service and process issues. And so we're looking at this savings statute to see if there's some way to find a useful and good solution that can cut down on the appellate cases and deal with the issue properly. We've had one meeting that was very productive. We've gotten a lot of useful help from Dave Hendricks and a couple of the attorneys that are on the work group. And Professor Holland is just in the process of following that up now with a second memo on the matter, and we'll probably have a meeting mid-January.
Very good. Any questions for Tom? If not, Marital Property Work Group. Professor Vail.
And if you look at Exhibit G, the Marital Property Work Group, as you remember, has received the Commission's okay to look at the Uniform Marital Property Act. We had Dave Hendricks' office put that into Oregon form in the form of a legislative draft. And we are now proposing to disseminate that draft to all the sections of the Oregon State Bar and ask for comments back to the work group before we take any further action. The letter that you see as Exhibit G is a letter that was drafted by the Executive Director's office and is going to go out to the new incoming chairs of all the bar sections in January. Because the bar section leadership changes in January, and with the responses we get, if any, from the Oregon bar sections, we're going to then go back to meeting with the work group and decide what kind of recommendation to make to the Commission on the Uniform Marital Property Act.
Do you want to relate briefly your appearance before the fan law?
Yeah.
I hear that was very, very well done and entertaining to boot.
Yeah, in November, the family law section had their annual meeting at Salishan, and I participated in a kind of a town hall meeting, pro-con argument about the Uniform Marital Property Act with Jacqueline Koch, who's a practicing attorney and an expert in family law, and one of my former students, as a matter of fact. And we had quite a good time doing a little give-and-take dog and pony show on what the act is all about and how it would affect Oregon law. And evidently it was fairly well received by the members of the family law section. We handed out as part of the materials in their handbook for the CLE a copy of the Uniform Marital Property Act along with the commentary. So it's out there and circulating, at least in the family law section. And this letter will now get it out to all the other sections of the Oregon State Bar.
Very good. Any other questions? All right, then moving on next to a nonprofit social security delivery work group, Dave Kinnegy.
There is reason to really be grateful for written work plans approved by the Law Commission, and that's what happened with this work group, because this is one that could go in a lot of different directions if it isn't committed to something specific. And progress is being made presently with a research assistant in cooperation with the reporter for the work group, Professor Stephen Green, on the first item, item one of the work plan. The point being, there will be some research necessary before we even get into the business of trying to collect people to discuss and argue over the various issues related to social service delivery by nonprofits. And so that research is underway, and we will be putting Steve Blackhurst, who's agreed to help in chairing this group, together with our reporter pretty soon, probably in January when that first round of research is completed. And then we'll see what our next steps will be in forming up the work group and proceeding.
Questions, Chair?
Yes.
Could you refresh our recollection as to what point one is?
Yeah, I could if I had point one with me. Wendy, did you bring that?
Was it at the last meeting?
It was. It would be in the minutes.
Yeah, it was in there.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right.
I don't know.
Well, it, no, it was in the exhibits to the last meeting.
Oh, okay.
Exhibit I.
It was exhibit I.
That's fine. I was just curious what...
No, she's got it from the last meeting. Wendy, go ahead. That was...
Okay, point number one was to identify and summarize various types of state laws, regulations, rules, and official policies and procedures that govern participation in or access to government programs, grants, et cetera.
That's the object of the research.
Yeah, that is step one research.
That identification of that law, body of law. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
I'm sorry, who's doing the research for us?
Well, Professor Stephen Green at the...
Professor Green.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Dave Hendricks, I think I have you down for the public body work group.
We did have one meeting. Well, this was probably back in September, and we had reported on that previously, basically indicating that the public body work group would work on a bill that would start with looking at the laws relating to special districts for purposes of starting to conform those statutes to the definitions adopted as part of the product from the last session's interim work group. I did ask the work group to hold off until January on meeting again, because this is one of those projects where basically they need to see the amended statutes to see what exactly the changes would be. And until we got the new ORS finished with, we didn't have the new statutes to amend. And we now have that, or we'll have it shortly here. And so hopefully in January or February, we'll be meeting again to take a look at a draft and start looking at whether or not we're going to be able to do a bill of this nature relating to starting to conform the statutes to the definitions adopted in the bill last session.
What color are the ORSs this year?
We're going back to something, I don't think people are calling it a burgundy, but it will be a reddish.
Oh, I remember that. Any other questions? Any pertinent questions?
I can, not a reference back to the kinds of questions you've been.
That was a reference to the kind of question I had just asked about the color of the ORSs. I was calling myself on that, folks. Number of the war. I'm glad you asked. Everyone could have left offended.
Almost certainly would have.
Is that me? Number 11, landowner liability status trichotomy. Professor Vetri.
This has been in limbo since last December, and I plan to get back to life sometime in January and discuss with the chair of the work group and get it up and running.
Good. I'd like to see that one. I remember talking about it when we first set that up, and it sounds very interesting. If there's no other discussion on the work group updates, I think that concludes that item and does take us to other business, and all I have under other business is the proposed dates for 2002. We've got some issue as to the March date.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to consider moving that, please, to Friday the 8th at 9 a.m.
At what time?
At 9 a.m.
Okay.
March 8th.
March 8th. And as you can see, we have packed a few extra meetings into the end of the year.
Yeah.
That's anticipating, as has happened now in the last couple of biennia, that we will be receiving bill drafts by that time. And do I understand is the last Judiciary Committee meeting that must be scheduled for the 23rd?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have it, I forget if we're a week or two before, but the November meeting is scheduled
ahead of the Judiciary
Committee. Ahead of that Judiciary Committee.
The purpose of that being if we can get our drafts ready to go by that November 22nd deadline, we'll have the opportunity as a commission to adopt them formally and then present them to the Judiciary Committee for introduction as committee bills. December 13 is sort of our fail-safe date. If we have some extra bills that aren't ready on the 22nd, at that point then those would have to go in as member bills, which we've done before, and that's not the end of the world, but it's nice if we can get these in as committee bills, I think.
Mr. Chair, what are the times of these dates?
These will be
from March 8th.
It seems to me 9 is probably best. I want to be sensitive to the folks who are coming in from out of town. Probably easier to get home at
4:30?
Yeah.
From my standpoint, it's better if they're in the afternoons. I don't know whether it's a preference for
really?
I don't know what days of the week I'll have classes, for example, but usually they're in the mornings, and so most afternoons I could probably make.
It's okay with me. We're getting another Portland degree.
I have the same problem. Fridays. I have a class Friday morning from 9 to 11.
So. Congressman, do you have a preference? Caught him.
A new member we haven't been introduced to?
No, I'll explain this in a minute. Okay, let's go. If nobody objects, then we'll try at 3 o'clock.
How about 1?
How about 4:30?
That was my suggestion.
4:30?
No.
No.
The
problem with 3 is that, like, I won't be able to leave now until, like, 5:30 or 6 because the traffic is too bad. Otherwise, I don't mind. It's just that it makes for a very long Friday. Is 1 okay for you guys? You guys want the 4:30? Okay.
2. I could do 2.
2
is okay with me.
2, okay.
All right, we'll go 2 o'clock. We'll try 2.
Now, on March 8th, I hope we're not talking about March 8th.
No. Why?
We need that one to be at 9 if we possibly can. Otherwise, there'll have to be another week at least.
Is that right?
For the law school, we're tied up. That's our
business. Okay, then we'll do March 8th at 9 o'clock. And the other dates we will set at least preliminarily at 2 o'clock. And if that becomes problematic, we can always adjust that as the year goes by.
4:30?
No, I was kidding.
I'm not going there.
2 o'clock.
On the others. Congressman Williams thing before we turn out, I just will say that Christy Yamaguchi and a Swiss skater by the name of Lucinda Roux believe through no fault of our own that they met Congressman Shetterly and Congressman Williams last weekend.
Where did you meet them? How fun.
In Washington, D.C. I'll tell you. No, that was very interesting. But once the cat's out of the bag, it's kind of embarrassing.
It's kind of a nice ring to it, actually.
All right, that takes care of our other dates, and I think we're up to adjournment then. Is there any other business from commission members? If not, the meeting is adjourned, and I want to thank everybody and have a good holiday.
Yay!
Good meeting.
Are we off?
Not yet.
Yeah. We also met the president's.
What did you mean?
Senior speechwriter.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm all just serendipity.
Wish I'd known.
I don't wear tights. No. And I don't golf.
Thank you. Yeah.